This is Matt from Solidarity House, and if you like this content and want more of it and want it to continue to be made available for people for free, please support us on patreon.com/solidarityhouse. For $5 a month, you can subscribe to our podcast and receive premium content, full interviews, original music, that sort of thing when it comes out. And most importantly, you will be supporting the continued content and activities of the Solidarity House Cooperative.
My name is Eric Atchison. I'm an ordained pastor in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which, if you haven't heard of us, most people haven't. We're this tiny, relatively small denomination that spun off from the Presbyterians about 200 years ago. So if you've been to a Presbyterian church, we're pretty similar. I've got a little adorable one-year-old daughter who is the very peak of my existence right now, and I adore her completely and utterly. I'm going to try not to gush about her here. And when I'm not actively in parish ministry in my off time, I do a lot of writing and activism. I found social media to be a really useful tool for that. And it's been a great way for me to be able to keep in touch with other people who are doing amazing work like you.
And you have a fantastic book out called Oregon Trail Theology, which is designed to kind of reach, I think, my impression is, you know, reach younger people, millennials, mm-hmm. millennial Christians, as well as, you know, folks who want to make their religion socially meaningful in their lives.
Yes. It's sort of an affirmation to my generation of sort of saying that this, you're not imagining it when we look at sort of the American Christianity, predominantly white American Christianity, in which our entire lives has been most prominently displayed in the religious right of the Christian Coalition, the Moral Majority, and now the support of the current president. It's partly for my generation, but it's also for non-millennials who sort of are trying to figure us out amid all of the beloved mediocre cultural institutions that we're busy killing.
I can't remember which to blame you for this week.
All of it.
Yeah. All of it. That's fine. Yeah. Burn it all down.
Total depravity isn't just a theological thing. It's the millennial generation just incarnates it.
You're forgiven here in this zone.
On my mother's side of the family, her grandparents, my great grandparents, were Armenian genocide refugees and survivors. In April of 1915, an order went out for the Armenian community in Istanbul to be arrested and most of them summarily executed. And that included my great uncle, Martiros Maradian. Within a week, he had been arrested, tortured, and executed. And another one of my great uncles, Avadis, had also been arrested. Upon this, my own great grandfather, my mother's grandfather, Krikor, was able to smuggle himself out of the country to safety in what was still then Tsarist Russia, but that would change within a couple of years. And a year later, my great-grandmother, my mother's grandmother, Satanig, lost her mother, my great-great-grandmother, Altun, in Karpert, and likewise had to flee the country. And the two of them fled across the entirety of Russia from sort of the area of Russia that most people think of with that's closer to Eastern Europe, all the way across Siberia to Vladivostok, and that's where they first met. And they went from Vladivostok down to Japan, to Yokohama Harbor, and separately to the United States, to Seattle and San Francisco in 1919, 3 to 4 years after they lost many in their family. They married, and their family eventually included my own mother. And so even though this is something that for them happened literally 100 years ago, my great-grandparents immigrated here 100 years ago this year, it's something that's still very vivid and profound in the memories of my mom's side of the family. And so it is very personal for us and is sort of this example, this illustration of how the personal is political and the political ultimately is personal. Look for Armenian voices. There's a bunch of us on social media. Armenian Twitter is definitely a thing. And so are Armenian historians and Armenian researchers. Peter Balakian at Colgate University has done tons of work into not just the story of the genocide, but his own family's history. And that tends to be a sort of a very common theme for Armenian researchers, is the placing of their own family's stories in this sort of much wider tapestry of what happened. So first of all, before I forget, there is a Senate resolution, and it's co-sponsored by maybe 20 or so senators. But as is so often the case with this particular Senate, what the majority leader wants, the majority leader gets, and Mitch McConnell absolutely does not want this to come up for a vote. So at least for the moment in the Senate, it is effectively buried. In the House, however, a couple of things have happened. One was sort of this disabusing of a lot of, I think, politicians, and this is a bipartisan tradition, of the threat that a nationalistic, proto-fascist, Erdogan-led government represents to its neighbors. The invasion of Syria completely disabused an awful lot of politicians who, to this date, were happy to either look the other way or actively deny what was sort of taking place and what was being built up under Erdogan in Turkey. Turkey's invasion of Syria completely laid that bare. And the fact that this president sort of endorsed it unilaterally certainly made it easier, at least for some Democratic politicians, to want to vote for this resolution without necessarily believing in the genocide's factuality or in its recognition. It was sort of a much more cynical, we're gonna stick it to Turkey for making us look like fools kind of a calculus. That being said, most of the co-sponsors of the resolution, long before Turkey had invaded Syria, the vast majority were progressive or leftist Democrats. Rashida Tlaib was a co-sponsor, Andre Carson, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Without sort of any sort of similar presence or solidarity of that level from the Republicans. So while there was a lot of sort of very cold calculating being done by a number of politicians, again, sort of this is a bipartisan tradition, I had always been sort of very taken a great deal of heart from the leftist and progressive politicians who had championed genocide recognition. And many of them had done so for months and years before before the vote took place.
I want to talk about one particular abstention or present voted present, and we don't have to just talk about this instance, mm-hmm. but that was Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who I would dare say the vast majority of our listeners are supporters and people who would consider themselves aligned with Representative Omar, and glad that she is in the House. And yet, and you and I have talked a little bit about this before, it seems egregious, cynical, or naive, one of those, that this present vote would occur. Afterwards, she kind of gave this sweeping and accurate criticism of geopolitics, which didn't seem to really get to the specific kind of call out of her sitting this one out, her kind of consciously choosing to do that. And so it's a painful conversation to have, but have at it.
Yeah, so I want to preface this by saying that in a vacuum, the argument that genocide recognition must include the United States treatment of indigenous tribes is not just a valid point, it's an important one. John Marshall Evans, who was once the U.S. ambassador to Armenia, before the George W. Bush administration had him recalled and ultimately sacked for his stance, his pro-genocide recognition stance. He used this term that I really like to try to describe what the United States has done to indigenous tribes. He calls it a rolling genocide, because a lot of historical genocides are sweeping actions that take place over just a few or just several years. The Armenian genocide took place over just several years. The Nazi Holocaust against the European Jews took place over just about 5 years. But our treatment of indigenous tribes is hundreds of years. So any conversation of genocide has to include this rolling genocide. And that's an absolutely valid point. But there were other ways for Representative Omar to make that point that didn't necessitate sort of a very gratuitous present vote. She could have voted yes and then issued that statement anyways.
Right.
Saying that, and I think a lot of progressive Armenian Americans would agree with her, that Armenian genocide recognition should lay the groundwork for not just recognition, but restitution for American treatment of indigenous tribes and of enslaved African and Caribbean American families. So that's it, it's maybe you call it incrementalism if you want to be cynical, but it does lay the groundwork for that, because one of the historical realities of the Armenian genocide is, just as with the Holocaust or the Rwandan genocide, or the Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs today, the U.S. bears some complicity in its inaction. Henry Morgenthau, who was Woodrow Wilson's ambassador to the Ottoman Empire, was raising alarm bells to the U.S. government for years about the genocide, and the U.S. government refused to act, just like it refused to act during World War II, just like it's refused to act in genocides across the world. So that recognition should come with it an acknowledgement that the U.S., of the U.S.'s complicity. Now, there's a bridge to be made here, because the U.S. isn't just complicit in the cleansing of indigenous tribes or the chattel enslavement of Blacks. It's absolute culpability. There needs to be a way to bridge that, but the way to do that isn't to issue what was effectively a vote for genocide denial, because in that particular context, voting present instead of no was a distinction without a difference. And I say that specifically because of one phrase that Representative Omar included in her statement, which was saying that decisions like genocide recognition should be based on academic consensus, which any Armenian American can tell you for decades has been a genocide denial canard.
It also seemed incredibly out of character to me from everything that I've known from studying other statements and speeches that Representative Omar has made that have with them an underlying sense of empathy and a genuine desire to bring empathy into political discourse in a way that I have felt was quite unique among our elected officials.
And I've yet to see that be borne out here. I don't want to go too much down the road of hearsay. I do have an Armenian American friend who is one of Representative Omar's constituents in Minnesota, who has asked for a meeting with her about her vote. And he simply said, we'll see. He hasn't, to my knowledge, hasn't heard back yet. If that's changed, I'll need to ask him.
That's unfortunate.
And, you know, when she, I know there was one, I think it was a BuzzFeed reporter, maybe. I want to say BuzzFeed, who asked Representative Omar, can I ask you a question about your Armenian genocide vote? And the representative simply said no. The unfortunate truth may be that, you know, dodging questions from reporters is a time-honored pastime in Congress for politicians, regardless of party, and that in some ways, Representative Omar is behaving like a politician when, you know, and our listeners know that her biography and the totality of her work is so much more than that of a typical politician's. By the same token, though, I mean, I do think that means that the expectations for her are high and should be high. You know, this is someone who has talked a really good game about human rights, about the rights of the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed. And far be it from a lot of Armenian Americans to claim that we should monopolize that conversation, but certainly what our ancestors endured needs to be a part of that what we learned is something that we can share at the table when it comes to discussions of human rights and what to do when those rights get deeply and profoundly abused. Even to this day, you have the State Department and the Senate and the White House tamping down genocide recognition. But where I think it really can help is that for a lot of progressive Armenian activists, we're already asking, all right, what's next? Like, now that this groundwork has been laid, how can this act of recognition fit within the wider work of genocide recognition, education, and justice? Because what happened to us is not isolated. A lot of what took place and a lot of the denial that takes place has a lot in common with genocide denial of any other genocide, of Holocaust denial, of denial of the genocide of the Rohingya in Myanmar, or of the Yazidis in the Middle East. And so we're already asking, how can we build on this? Like, this was never meant to be a finish line. It was always sort of one stepping stone along this very long journey towards a genuine ethic of human rights. And the energy that I think that has created is real. And I think it's important, especially as we're about to enter a presidential election year, whether or not we're going to choose to elect a president who fundamentally shares that ethic, who shares that respect for basic human rights. And I think it's an absolute moral imperative that we do so. I would like to call out actually a lot of the people, even though I've called out Representative Omar here, I'd like to call out a lot of the people who have called her out, because she was not the only one who voted present, and all of the no, and with one exception, every other present or no vote was a Republican, including the vice president's own brother. This does fit, I think, into a broader theme of criticizing, whether it's Representative Omar or the other members of the quote-unquote squad, or of progressive leftist leaders in general, singling them out because of their religion or race or ethnicity or gender. Because the other genocide deniers in Congress are mostly conservative white men. And I'm not seeing Paul Gosar or Greg Pence dragged anywhere near the degree that I'm seeing Representative Omar being dragged. And I do think she merits criticism for the vote, and I think has received a lot of that legitimate criticism. She has also received a lot of renewed Islamophobia and xenophobia for that vote. And Islamophobia in the name of genocide recognition is not an act of solidarity. That does not make you my friend. It does not make us allies. And I will continue to fight for recognition and justice without you.
Reverend Eric Acheson is a pastor in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ and the author of Oregon Trail Theology, The Frontier Millennial Christian's Face and How We're Ready. Just how we're ready. It just ends that way. Like, we're ready for it.
Maybe it should have ended with a question mark.
or a bring it. And then a new book, On Earth As It Is in Heaven.
Yes, and that will be coming out in April of 2020, and it's about a faith-based approach towards economic justice that will include conversations drawn from the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, or what some Christians call the Old Testament, the New Testament, and sort of an examination of how the church, the Western church, has really fallen short of the expectations in those texts and what we can do about it. And that includes a whole conversation on reparations, on reallocation of resources and wealth and education, access to healthcare. I'm really looking forward to it. I had a lot of fun writing it, and I hope that you all will look forward to reading it.
I do look forward to it, and look forward to having you back on when we can have a chance to discuss that book. And as you know, many of those themes are near and dear to my heart. Eric is also an Armenian American, and we thank you so much. It's been a great honor to have you here educating us and calling us to action on the recent U.S. House genocide resolution.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks again to Reverend Eric Acheson for being on and talking about his family's experiences with the Armenian genocide, as well as the U.S. and global politics of genocide recognition. Unfortunately, to no one's surprise, what would have been the Senate resolution on genocide recognition was blocked this week. Lindsey Graham did the dubious honors of blocking that, and I don't think that Eric, if he were still joining us, would be surprised about that. Thanks again for listening, everybody, and stay tuned for more content coming from the Solidarity House Media Network.